It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about higher education programs for incarcerated people through the federal government's Second Chance Pell Grant pilot program as new regulations take effect. According to the U.S. Department of Education, the program has expanded to over 200 colleges and universities nationwide. Call in with a question, share a comment at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Sadiq Isahaku is Dean of General Education, Academic and Career Pathway at Milwaukee Area Technical College and Administrator of Correctional Education Programs. Sadiq, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
The national ban was lifted this month for people who are incarcerated to receive federal student Pell Grant. What is your reaction to that development?
We're very excited about the expansion. It is going to give opportunities to a lot more incarcerated individuals to pursue post-secondary education and training.
How will it expand it? What do you envision?
Well, so we at Milwaukee Area Technical College were already the first institution in the state to be granted experimental status in 2016. So we have been educating individuals since then. The expansion over the years included Madison College and Moraine Park Technical College. Now the July 1st expansion will allow every higher education institution that is interested to apply to the Federal Department of Education to be considered as a Pell site so that they too could offer education programs to incarcerated individuals across the state.
To be a Pell Grant site, though, you also have to work in collaboration with the State Department of Corrections to, you know, keep the program going. How would you characterize that partnership?
For us, the partnership is going very well. It could be better. We have mentioned very many times that we have capacity to register and offer educational programs and training to a lot more students than we currently do. I'm sure you are aware, it's public record that there are so many students on wait lists for education programs. And we, technical colleges across the state, are ready and capable to offer those training opportunities to students. But unfortunately, there are many other demands on the incarcerated individuals regarding other programming that we are not able to have access to everybody.
So ready and capable to deploy training programs and college credits. We're going to get into that wait list in just a moment. How much could Pell Grant access affect the opportunities of people who are incarcerated?
Well, it will grant them opportunities for a second chance. Basically, what the initial program was, granting second chances to individuals who probably did not take advantage of the first chances they had initially. And what it does is that there is ample research out there suggesting that post-secondary education and training has a tendency of reducing recidivism and also offering individuals opportunities for family-sustaining wages when they are released, and that will prevent them from returning to crime.
So you feel like going to college while in prison affects reentry when you're released and your chances of never being incarcerated again? Do you think it makes an impact there?
It absolutely does. There is, as I mentioned, there is ample research out there that suggests this is a huge impact. If people have post-secondary education, their chances of committing certain types of crimes is low. For instance, if you look at the number of people who are incarcerated, this is a very small percentage who have college degrees. Majority of those who are incarcerated did not complete college.
Sadiq Isahaku is Dean of General Education, Academic and Career Pathway at Milwaukee Area Technical College as we talk about new Pell Grant eligibility opportunities for people who are incarcerated. You can join in with your question. You can share an experience. You can share a comment at 800-642-1234. Sadiq, as you mentioned, since 2016, Milwaukee Area Technical College has been participating in this Second Chance Pell Grant experiment that was launched by the Obama administration in 2015. So as you look back, what are you learning from being a part of this program or, you know, what the federal government calls it, an experiment?
We learned that it is an incredible opportunity. When it was banned 26 years ago, it deprived individuals who are incarcerated and who were only subjected to taking courses, either those offered by technical colleges through some specific arrangements with the Department of Corrections across the country, or students were taking correspondence courses, many of which were not offered by institutions that were credible. So there was a hunger for education. And what we have realized is that when students get into our programs, the excitement is overwhelming. During our graduation ceremonies, you can see very clearly what this has meant to them. It's usually a moment where individuals celebrate an achievement. Being incarcerated is not an achievement, but completing college and getting a credential, and especially a credential that you can use to secure a family-sustaining wage, is overwhelmingly important.
So in June, 49 people who are incarcerated graduated from three state technical colleges. And since your college joined the Second Chance Pell Grant program, you know, about 200, I understand, have graduated. What are some of these students doing now? Have you followed them?
Yes, we have, as you know, after graduation follow-up is usually a voluntary thing that students would provide us.
Mm-hmm.
No requirement. However, those we follow very closely are those who are in the center systems around Milwaukee and come to us for welding and CNC, computer numeric controls training. Those ones we know do get jobs most of the time during the second week before their graduation. We have employers lined up ready to hire them upon release. And some of them are already on work release. So they, even after they complete the credential, they actually can use that to start working and earning more pay. So that's what we have seen. The 49 you mentioned in June, 31 of them happened to be from Milwaukee Area Technical College. They graduated from us. The unfortunate thing is that a few complete the associate degree, but are still incarcerated. So as a result, they are eager to learn. They are hungry for more knowledge, and they lack the opportunity to transfer to a four-year institution to complete a bachelor's degree. However, the expansion may allow four-year institutions to join in offering Pell Grants. So this will be a great opportunity for individuals who have already completed their associate degree programs in science and arts to continue their four-year degrees while still incarcerated.
Sadiq Isahaku is Administrator of Correctional Education Programs at Milwaukee Area Technical College. As we examine prison education programs in higher ed and circumstances with the Second Chance Pell Grant in Wisconsin, you can join the conversation at any point. Call in with a question at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We discuss a program giving people who are incarcerated access to college coursework as the U.S. Department of Education reinstates Pell Grant eligibility more broadly for incarcerated students. Join the conversation along the way. Call in with a question, share a comment at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Sadiq Isahaku is Dean at Milwaukee Area Technical College and Administrator of Correctional Education Programs. Sadiq, let's talk about the wait list. When you came on our program last fall, we talked about the wait lists here in Wisconsin correctional facilities for education programs. And at the time, the Career Technical Education Program had more than 10,000 people on the wait list. What is that like today?
To the best of my knowledge, I don't think we have dented the wait list significantly. We have had two other colleges join, but still the enrollment in our programs is not as robust as we would like it to be. So yes, we still have some way to go in order to reduce the wait list.
How could the wait list be reduced?
Access, access, access. We are an open access institution. WTCS, Wisconsin Technical College System, allows us to open our doors to all eligible students throughout the year. So if we have more access into the prison systems, we should be able to register, recruit, and train a lot more students than we currently do. And as I mentioned earlier, we have the capacity and infrastructure to make this happen.
Are people in state correctional facilities being excluded from job training and educational programs due to these wait lists, or are they able to access something?
Well, since they're on wait lists, of course, they have no access to those training, but if the wait list is not there, I mean, then everybody has access. Definitely, they might be. I cannot guarantee that, or, you know, that there might be some people who are waiting to get into these programs that we offer across the state and are not being able to because they have no access.
When you look at your enrollments at Milwaukee Area Technical College, what programs have the most, what programs are incarcerated people most interested in joining?
So the Associate of Science degree programs are our most robust, followed by the Associate of Arts, and then welding is another one. As you know, welding has a limited capacity. We can only take 12 students per semester because of the number of welding stations that we have in the lab. We are increasing that capacity by moving additional welding equipment into the Walker Square location. The Walker's Education Center is where we offer the welding. And once we do that, we may be able to double the, we'll be able to double the capacity. The Associate of Arts and Associate of Science degree are more popular because incarcerated individuals have 2 years to complete those degrees, and wonderfully they do so very well. And then they can continue to four-year institutions after that.
Going back to the welding facilities and the welding bays, are those bays set up inside correctional institutions?
In certain areas, in certain districts, yes. Many of the correctional facilities, especially the bigger ones, do have technical equipment installed inside the prisons. And technical colleges across the state go into the prisons or offer their curriculum to the prison staff to deliver those courses to individuals. So yeah, we have a variety of processes and procedures that we use to offer those courses.
It makes me wonder about other hands-on programs that involve a lot of either clinical setting or a hands-on environment like a construction site. Are those barriers to be able to go into those types of programs?
Well, yes. Occasionally, it does happen that some of the prison systems have, for instance, bricklaying is offered in there. And advanced manufacturing, I know Madison Area Technical College offers that as well. So, yes, as long as there is space, in the prison for us to install equipment, we will be able to offer any of those. Construction courses are very popular when they are available, and we do offer a few of them.
As the Second Chance Pell Grant opens up, more colleges sign on to it. What advice do you have for Wisconsin, you know, institutions that want to start a prison education program?
Yes, within the technical college system, we collaborate and share our experiences since 2016 with those institutions that are interested in joining. We know that there are a few four-year institutions that are also working their way in to get eligibility to offer this program. So yes, the advice will be that they need to have staff dedicated to the program. They need to develop strategies where if there are lockdowns, they can still offer their courses in there, so there's no interruption for the course offerings. Their instructors are trained on how to offer instruction to incarcerated individuals. There are a few differences in the processes and procedures, what we need to pay attention to, and how we need to do this diligently to ensure that the primary focus of the Department of Corrections is preserved, and that is security.
Sadiq Isahaku with us, Dean of General Education, Academic and Career Pathway at Milwaukee Area Technical College, as we discuss the Second Chance Pell Grant program and the expansion of it. You can join in with your questions and comments at 800-642-1234. Sadiq, the State Department of Corrections, it reports more than 20,000 people are incarcerated in Wisconsin as of the most recent census, and three technical colleges are participating in the Pell Grant experiment. What challenges could face other prisons where inmates have been ineligible for the Pell Grant?
I think the main obstacle is whether the Department of Corrections has enough staff inside the prison to help in the recruitment and course offering opportunities within the department's education centers in the prisons. Right now, capacity is an issue.
What about filling out the paperwork? I mean, applying for financial aid like the Pell Grant could involve a computer, could involve tax documentation or proof of financial need. Do incarcerated people have access to these tools to apply for this program?
Yeah, those are not obstacles. We have not confronted them yet. We believe that the Department of Corrections has enough computers for students to use in completing their FAFSA. They complete the FAFSA online under the supervision of a correctional site coordinator inside the prison. We also offer guidance to them as well. So yeah, computers are not really a major issue. We have also been given opportunities by the DOA, the Department of Education, to offer what we call clear books. There are some types of secure laptops that inmates are issued with that they can use to attend school even when they are in prison, in their cells. So yeah, computers have not been a major opportunity. I mean, a major...
That's not a barrier. What is your response to opponents of using taxpayer dollars to fund the education of people who have committed serious crimes?
Yeah, serious crimes, you're right. You know, this expansion actually is sentence blind. It's regardless of the conviction or the length of the conviction, this new guidelines allows everybody who is incarcerated to access education and training. The Department of Wisconsin has its own, Wisconsin Department of Corrections has its own probably restrictions that may hinder some people from having access. But overall, we think that a dollar spent or invested in prison education will be probably several dollars saved in the end. If you look at the data that comes out, the amount of money we spend on incarceration will be reduced if the number of people getting in the first place is reduced.
And that is because they have the skills and the degree once they are released from prison.
Absolutely.
Sadiq, thank you so much for joining us.
You are very welcome. Thank you for having me.
Sadiq Isahaku is Dean of General Education Academic and Career Pathway at Milwaukee Area Technical College and Administrator of Correctional Education Programs. We've been talking about the expansion of the Second Chance Pell Grant program. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We dig into why childhood vaccination rates are in decline here in Wisconsin, across the nation, and globally, and ways to improve access and boost confidence in vaccines. You can be part of the conversation. Call in with a question, a comment at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Stephanie Schauer is director of the Wisconsin Vaccination Program at the Department of Health Services. Stephanie, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much.
Good morning. Lily Caprani here as well, head of Global Advocacy for Health, Nutrition, and Climate at UNICEF. Lily, welcome.
Good morning.
Lily, let's start with you. World Health Organization and UNICEF reporting that over 20 million children missed at least one routine vaccine last year. And that's an improvement from 2021, but it lags behind immunization rates before the pandemic. Why has the pandemic disrupted childhood vaccination?
Well, that's right. UNICEF is working all around the world on children's health, and part of that is making sure they get their routine immunizations. And each year throughout the pandemic, we were tracking how things were doing and seeing a huge backsliding, kind of loss of the number of children who were missing out on really basic immunizations like measles, diphtheria, polio, things that have been taken for granted for generations now. And part of that, I think we just expected it because, you know, there was so much disruption. A lot of us were closed away in our homes. We couldn't get our children to the clinic and do the usual things during lockdowns. But we really expected to see a better recovery after the pandemic kind of wound down. And so we've been warning that we're worried that numbers didn't quite get back to where they should have done. They are starting to recover, but a lot of children are still missing out on basic vaccines, even despite health clinics being back open as usual. So, I mean, we really need to dig in and understand what's going on here and what's causing that, because that's putting a lot of children's lives at risk of basic childhood illnesses again.
Let's put the spotlight on Wisconsin, Stephanie. What are you seeing here in our state?
Yeah, so I think it's some of the same challenges. You know, we know that children who were born in 2020 or turned one that year had delays in care during the key vaccination times. The children receive, you know, a number of vaccines between birth and 2 years of age. And, you know, before the pandemic, we measure children by 24 months of age for seven different vaccine series. And in 2019, that was at 72%. And go to 2021 and 2022, that dropped to 69%. Now, while those numbers may not seem like a significant decrease, that when we're talking about a large statewide population, that's a lot of children in our communities who are not protected. And even on a good day, 3 out of 10 were not protected. If we look at just take the measles, mumps, rubella vaccine, for example, measuring one dose by 24 months of age, in 2013, we had 88% of our children protected, and by 2022, we had dropped to 82%. So certainly some of the impacts that the pandemic had are continuing And as we said, we are hoping for renewed interest and access to receive vaccines here in Wisconsin as we are for the rest of the world.
Stephanie, as you look at that data across Wisconsin and look at those numbers, are there pockets, are there regions of the state that are lagging behind in childhood vaccinations?
Yeah, we definitely see regional and county variability. For example, the MMR rate that I talked about, some of our lowest county rates are between 48 and 62% coverage compared to some that are at the highest, around 88 or 89%. So we definitely see that variable. But even when we talk about, at the county rate, that's almost too large. We have to think about this really as a more local community, and it's important to about the rates that are, in where you're shopping and working and playing and going to school. And we know that there can be pockets where folks are not nearly as vaccinated as much as we would like, and that those rates drop lower than we need to prevent disease transmission. So we certainly have, variability throughout the state for a number of different reasons.
Lily, does UNICEF approach childhood vaccination as a local community issue, as Stephanie is talking about?
Absolutely. We know that it doesn't matter where you live in the world, what you choose to do for your child's health is one of the most important decisions you can make. And you tend to take that information and that decision very, very seriously and think hard and long about who you listen to and who you're going to go to for advice. So it's very affected by who's around you, what's being said in your family, what's being said in your friendship group, your community, with other parents around you. And therefore, it's a very, very localized issue, quite a personal and quite an emotional issue for all families when they think about their child's health. And that means we have to really understand what's going on when parents are deciding maybe not to take their child to get those really important early vaccines for the very, very young child. And there's lots of complicated reasons about why people make different decisions about that. What we want to really understand is what's happened during the pandemic that's changed the numbers so much. It is getting better. I will say lots of the numbers we look at around the world are improving in most countries, including in the US. In the poorest countries of the world, they're having the biggest struggle to catch up, largely because of not having the resources to do so. And because it's so, the disruptions to those health services, those health services had so little in the way of resources in the first place. But I know in the US and in a lot of the rich countries, we're also facing challenges with where are parents getting their information from? How are they making these choices and decisions? And we all, every institution and every healthcare worker and professional has a role in making sure that we tackle this issue now.
Talking about the decline in childhood vaccination rates around the world and here in Wisconsin, Lily Caprani there is head of global advocacy at UNICEF. Stephanie Schauer directs Wisconsin's vaccination program at Department of Health Services. You can join in on childhood vaccination. Your questions, your comments are welcome at 800-642-1234. Stephanie, I'm wondering, as we talk about trust and at the community level, is vaccine hesitancy a piece of this?
Yeah, it certainly is. And, I think there's sort of two pieces that affect vaccination rate. One is that willingness or the interest, desire to be vaccinated. We know that parents have questions, and rightly so. The problem is not having questions. It's really making sure that they're getting the answers that they need. And healthcare providers are such a key piece of this. We trust our healthcare providers regarding the health of our children. We take them there for regular checkups. And it's important that we ask them the questions that we have about vaccines so that we feel comfortable making the decisions to protect our children. For example, there's lots of misunderstanding about how vaccines work and how long they stay in the body. They're really a transient way of teaching your body to recognize a particular virus or bacteria and allows your immune system to build up. The vaccine is really sort of a teacher, and that they are short-lived in the body. And having folks understand how vaccines work and what they do and don't do is so key. And I think healthcare providers are key in that. The other piece that I just want to mention is that we're very fortunate here in the US and in Wisconsin is to have the Vaccines for Children program. This is a program that's a federal program whereby it addresses that issue of cost, and that should not be a barrier for children who don't have private insurance that covers vaccines. So this program covers children who are uninsured, who don't have insurance that covers vaccines, are on Medicaid, Alaska Native, or American Indian, and they can access the vaccines free of charge. It's a network of 720 locations throughout the state, including healthcare providers and local and tribal health departments. And nearly every place that serves children, you know, for primary care is part of this program. And they screen every child to see if they're eligible. So we really want to make sure that that access point, once a parent has gotten the information and made the decision to have their child vaccinated, that cost isn't a barrier.
Lily, what about that at a global level? Where can families get that affordable and accessible vaccines for their child?
It's such a good point. Apart from anything else, it just needs to be easy and it needs to be affordable to get your child vaccinated. Nothing should stand in the way, whether that's, you know, the convenience of getting to the local clinic or whether it's, can you afford the journey there? Nothing should stand in the way of something that's just such a basic right for children's health and well-being and for the community. I think the other thing we have to remember is not just parents do need to understand how vaccines work. They also need to understand the kinds of illnesses that we're talking about protecting children from. And I think it was understandable during the COVID pandemic, certainly at the beginning, that, you know, COVID vaccines were new. We were all learning about them for the first time. We were learning about COVID as an illness for the first time. But when we talk about childhood vaccines, we're in a whole different world. We're talking about very well-established vaccines that have been around since our grandparents were getting vaccinated, and illnesses that perhaps we've kind of taken it for granted that they're not a big problem anymore. You know, we don't see in our grandparents' generation, children were still living in iron lungs from having polio. Mm-hmm. There were many families who, you know, probably still now have grandparents who maybe suffer from the after effects of polio or of measles that can affect things like your hearing and your breathing. We don't see it so often, but let me tell you, these diseases are making a comeback now. We're starting to see some outbreaks of illnesses that we used to think we had dealt with. And perhaps we need to tell families a bit more about some of those risks and why it's so important to protect our children against those illnesses, because they can really sweep through communities very quickly when they get a hold.
I think that's such an interesting point, because if the disease, measles, mumps, rubella, diphtheria, I mean, if they're getting vaccinated for it, but it's not present in their lives, in their community, there is that question, do I still need to vaccinate my child?
Yeah, exactly. You may think, you know, I'm going to weigh up the risks here. It seems to me like I don't want to take any, you know, risks with my child's health. Of course, nobody does. But maybe we don't see the risk mm-hmm. of these illnesses because they just haven't been a common part of everyday life in the richer world. I mean, we've seen, we're starting to see a few of these measles outbreaks where it's just remarkable how quickly they can spread when a community isn't vaccinated. You know, if you live in a pocket of a community or a neighborhood where the majority have not had a measles vaccine, you will see that spread around like wildfire. It's one of the most infectious illnesses, and it can really damage children. If they don't die from measles, they can certainly suffer from long after effects from that illness. But we don't see it as often, and therefore perhaps we don't see the risk as often. Mm. But I think it's an important part of just thinking through the challenge for all of us, all healthcare workers and all professionals who are talking to families about these decisions.
UNICEF's head of global advocacy for health, nutrition, and climate, Lily Caprani, there. We have the director of the Wisconsin Vaccination Program, Stephanie Schauer, calling with a question, a comment as well about childhood vaccines. The number to join the conversation is 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Tens of millions of children across the world are missing one or more childhood vaccinations, according to UNICEF. We examine this backslide in recent years and Wisconsin's approach to protecting children from vaccine-preventable diseases. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Stephanie Schauer directs the Wisconsin Vaccination Program at the Department of Health Services. And Lily Caprani is here, leads global advocacy for health, nutrition, and climate at UNICEF. Lily, as you look around the world, how much is misinformation about the COVID pandemic damaging trust in public health care?
There's no doubt that throughout the pandemic period, we saw a big explosion in the amount of conversation generally about vaccines, you know, especially online and in the media. We were just talking about it a whole lot more than we ever were before. And in some ways, that's a great thing. You know, every single family in the world was having a conversation about vaccines, probably for the first time ever. But it also saw an explosion in kind of, you know, both good and bad information being out there, some very informed by expertise and some of it less so. And I think we saw across the world, and obviously the United States is no exception. If anything, it's probably the most extreme example of where some of that information got very politicized, very polarized, divided opinion. And I think it's complicated, right? On the one hand, it's very understandable that people would have a lot of questions and want to discuss and debate something as important as a brand new vaccine and how public health authorities were communicating about this new disease that was sweeping the world. And it was a difficult job because the science was changing every day. The facts about the pandemic were changing so fast. It's a really hard job to be able to keep the public informed with up-to-date, accurate information when it's changing so quickly. But I think what's been really sad to see is that some of that uncertainty has also now spilled over into how we think about childhood vaccines that we've had since the 60s. And some of the questions and some of the more political points being made have kind of spilled over into this whole other area. And that worries us a great deal. If it's having an important impact on decisions about children's health that otherwise parents were making, where they were happy to take their child along to get a measles vaccine and have been doing so for generations, then we've got a real problem to tackle there. This can't be allowed to become a victim of some of that political discourse. It's children's health. It's just too important.
Stephanie, in light of that spillover Lily's talking about of misinformation infiltrating childhood vaccination schedules, what has the state health department, what is it doing differently now with how it approaches routine vaccines?
Yeah, so I think one of the things that we're doing and was really started in earnest during the pandemic is working with community-based organizations. So working with folks in the communities to help be the messengers and provide information about vaccines, and so that the message is coming from trusted messengers within the community and not just, you know, on social media, but from someone they know. As I think Lily mentioned, it's so local, and what your, you know, friends and family say has real impact. And really, we are trying to work with a variety of different groups to carry that message forward about the importance of vaccines, and sort of and what they can do and the benefits that they have in allowing, you know, children to live long, happy, healthy lives, and, you know, well into adulthood. So that's one piece. And then the other, you know, we are continuing to support that Vaccines for Children network and ensure that providers have the information they need, that network is strong and accessible to all families, ensuring that folks are aware of the that network and can receive the vaccines without charge. So those are a few of the things, but I would add.
I wonder, Stephanie, have you seen a tendency, perhaps a trend to pick and choose childhood vaccines, almost like a buffet table?
Yeah, so we just looked at the school compliance data. So every year, children are required to have certain vaccines for school, although they can go ahead and have waivers. We do have waivers here in the States, and we just looked at the most recent 2022-2023 school year, and we did see an increase in the number or the percentage of children with waivers to one or more vaccines, and it went from 4.6% to 5.4%. So that is a concerning number. As I said, it may be for one or more vaccines, but we do continue to watch that and be concerned that parents may be choosing not to receive certain vaccines.
Stephanie Schauer there directs Wisconsin's vaccination program. Lily Caprani is with us, head of global advocacy at UNICEF, as we talk about the decline in childhood vaccination rates and next steps around the world. And here in Wisconsin, you can join in with your questions. You can ask, share a comment at 800-642-1234. Lily, how low do vaccination rates need to fall in order to affect public health in general? Are you watching that at UNICEF?
So that's a great question. As we keep saying, it's very local, this issue. So you tend to see pockets of this happening. So it's not like, one in every 50 families chooses not to vaccinate their children. It tends to be more like certain communities, certain neighborhoods, certain social groups, and therefore you tend to have many children within a particular group or area not receiving vaccines, and that's why it becomes even more dangerous, because these are infectious diseases. It doesn't just put at risk that individual child, but the neighborhood, the society around them. And if there's one lesson we all learned from the pandemic, surely it must be that this is about keeping not just ourselves safe, but our whole families and communities and all of those around us, because these diseases don't respect borders. They spread very quickly and they can affect whole communities. They can shut down schools and so on. And it doesn't take very much. It just takes us, a small in one neighborhood, it can just be a handful of families making those decisions, and then it starts to affect everyone around and the elderly and others who are vulnerable. We've seen these outbreaks starting in certain countries already. And it worries us a great deal, particularly amongst children who maybe already have other vulnerabilities. Maybe they don't have the best nutrition, or they don't have the best access to other kinds of healthcare or treatments, maybe due to not having the resources available to them. And then illnesses that might sound like very common childhood illnesses can quickly become quite lethal and life-threatening for them and their communities.
Well, Lily and Stephanie, thank you so much for your work. Thank you for joining us.
Thanks so
Thank
much.
you.
Stephanie Schauer is director of the Wisconsin Vaccination Program at the State Department of Health Services. Lily Caprani is head of global advocacy for health, nutrition, and climate at UNICEF. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.